Well, thank you, Chris. I don't think I'm going to be able to point at the thing anyhow, so. Okay, I'll try that. Anyhow, I just want to tell you what an honor it is for me to be here, and especially because there's so many more people more worthy than me sitting out in the audience, and I appreciate the ability to be able to talk to y'all today. As you can see, the title of my talk, and we was talking to Chris and to Mark about what to title this talk and what to emphasize. It was kind of like emphasizing like that's what this meeting is about. You know, it's called the Green Revolution 2.0. It's not that what we did contributed so much to the Green Revolution. It's just that it's the movement during my lifetime, especially, and as we've moved and especially forage breeding from how we did it in the good old days, which we always hear a lot about, to what we're doing today in a technological era. I'm also I'm not naive enough to think that my own career was anything. It's just that I think all people at my age, and there's a lot of y'all out here too. So I started looking, why am I always asked to give talks like this now, especially over the last 2 or 3 years? Philosophy, future, that kind of stuff. And then I realized I really did a lot of, in fact, this talk's going to be, I told Han out there a while ago that this talk's going to be long on philosophy and short on data. But so that's another reason. But as I really looked at what was going on and collected a lot of data about why people of my age do this kind of work, kind of talks, I came up with a nice graph. It fit very well. It's almost a perfect correlation. And if you look early in your career, you're all working. I mean, everybody works hard. And as you get older, you notice out there where I am, and it's all talk. I mean, that's all we do. And I'll show you a database that I used, one of the databases I used. And you can see all these people are just talkers, you know. Now, the only person that blew my model out was Monty Roquette. He was talking early. I don't see Monty. I saw him yesterday. But I am pleased and very honored to be talking today. I want to show you something, and I hesitated to do this, but I think it did define a little bit my era a little bit. And that's me. Growing up on a Mississippi Delta farm and around Leland, Mississippi, right in the middle of blues country. You can see there's chickens in the yard, and you know we were all raised in a farming community. As many of y'all and many people in my era were came into this business coming from a farming background. I don't know how important that was. I think what it did in a general way was give us an idea of the whole thing, you know, especially coming at it from a production standpoint and coming at it from a how you make your living standpoint. I think you were just ingrained with that from the beginning. Also, just educated through the Leland and Mississippi Public Schools, so if there's an honor today, give it to the Mississippi Public Schools. Woohoo! You know, they've arrived. Of course, Mississippi State, went to Mississippi State, went to the land-grant university there, and my advisor actually and got me into grasses at that time. I was just a row crop guy and got it into grasses was Coleman Ward. And many of y'all know Coleman was a forage and studied under Roy Blazer and was at Mississippi State for many years. And then when I went to the University of Florida for my graduate work, I was very privileged to work with two grass breeders there, Al Dudek for my master's degree and Rex Smith for my PhD. And then I went to, as Chris said, the University of Georgia and was able to establish my career there and really just had a lot of interesting people I worked with and everything. And then finally, the crowning achievement really was working for the Noble Foundation. I tell all my university friends, especially back at the University of Georgia, I said, it's really nice to work for a proper organization for a while. You know, not that the University of Georgia wasn't, it was a great organization, but we had funding at the Noble Foundation. As many of you know, that's a real critical feature. I look a lot smarter when my funding looks good, I have to admit. But I think this kind of sums up this era, too, of when I came, and a lot of y'all in the room started at about the same time. We came from farming backgrounds. We went through land-grant universities, and was heavily influenced either through our education through land-grant universities or through our association with land-grant universities. But things have really changed since that era. And I am going to emphasize that. And we not only have we moved from a technological era, but we're moving to an era where, in my view, we're going to have to be, the younger scientists are going to have to be a lot more clever and a lot more aggressive, even. There's a lot of serendipity in this talk, too, and even irony to me. My first meeting as a master's level graduate student for this meeting was in the Deauville Hotel in Miami Beach in 1972. Several of y'all were probably in the room. And as you can see, the first thing is Martin Massengale was president-elect. He was president, became president at that thing. And so very ironic that almost 40 years later, my first meeting, I'm giving the Massengale lecture. So that to me is an irony. And then there were three people who were chairs of the different divisions who greatly influenced my career. Carl Hovland, and many of you know Carl and I had a great relationship at the University of Georgia. Carl was a management ecologist person and great scientist. Harold Brown was a physiologist, and I worked closely with Harold and Carl Hovland. They were chairs of C6 and C2 at that time. And then Bill Caudill, who was chair of C3, was actually the guy who hired me. He saw enough in me to hire me for my first job, and so I thought this was very ironic. And the final part of this story really is that recently Dan Undersander and I had a great privilege to write a chapter in the Grassland book with Martin Massengale. And Martin's still pretty sharp, but wasn't he, Dan? He really added a lot to this chapter. And of course, one of the things we pointed out in this chapter, and as I was mentioning a minute ago for the younger scientists, funding is not what it used to be in the land-grant days. And we see less breeders, less management people, less in forages across the board. We're going to have to make do with less and be really clever. And so it's like I had an old spinster aunt used to say, I'm glad I'm going out instead of coming in. And maybe that's about where a lot of us are now. It's going to be a real challenge for the younger scientists. Continuing down this kind of theme of irony, serendipity, people, this was the crop science that came out. I hope it's a little small for some print. But 1972 in October, when I attended my first meeting, this was the issue of crop science. And as coming in as a young graduate level student studying plant breeding, I just highlighted three articles right in a row right there, and they have very interesting impact on me. First of all, some of the words that are used there, synthetics, combining ability. There's Dick Hill, and many of y'all know in alfalfa breeding was a real giant in alfalfa breeding. Recurrent selection. I mean, all these terms were very popular, and we all learned, and they still are popular today, but they were classic terms. Also, I highlighted there with the little red arrow a paper by Rex Smith, and Rex, again, became my major professor for my PhD, and Rex was one of the first people to apply isozymes in forage breeding, and he did that to show that he had sexual types of plants in guinea grass, which was supposed to be a classic apomec plant. He used isozymes as a tool to show it. And so when I went to work with Rex, I was probably influenced a lot by using tools, technological tools, in plant breeding. To the point now, with a paper that came out, I just leap forward now, almost again 40 years, and here is a paper that came out. Of course, I was just doing a lot of the basic whole plant work here, but Rebecca, and of course working with a colleague, Rain Parrott, and then a new scientist at Noble Foundation, Maria Monteros, we published a paper on leaf coloration and some of the things that have a little more ornamental value, less forage value, but look at the key words there, linkage group, logarithm of the odds, polymerase chain reaction, and all those and acronyms, PCR, and all that stuff. So if you're a breeder, you used to hear those terms when I first started, a recurrent selection, combining ability, dial Ls, et cetera, et cetera. And you still hear them today, but you really hear them, hear these kind of terms. And if you go to any of the posters out here, I challenge you to find a poster in breeding that doesn't have one of these terms in it. Also, you never know what another serendipity is that this particular paper, we had found some genes that were associated with the four-leaf clover, or the multi-leaf, really, what we found. And all of a sudden, people pick up on it, and it's in Bloomberg, and some of y'all might have seen it, and it's like, wow, what's going on here? You know, why are they so interested in this? And we're trying to work to feed people and feed cattle and stuff, and some of the papers we thought were more important are not as important as something that really catches the imagination of the press. And again, you know, that's maybe the era we're living in. But anyhow, this was just as an example. So let's start. When I started my career, and I thought when I talked to Chris, we would just use this career as a kind of a template, really, of how we've moved from, and myself especially, how we've moved from the good old days to this technology era. And when I started, and it's still kind of true today, forage breeding, especially in the southeastern United States, was Glen Burton, Bermuda grass, and Kentucky 31 tall fescue. And I'm telling you, if you didn't think that, you were mistaken. I had the privilege, because Dr. Burton was at Tifton, Georgia, I really had the privilege of getting a lot of advice from him over the years, as well as people like Carl Hovland. But he was very open with his knowledge, really. And I used to sit in his office every time I went to Tifton for many hours, and we'd talk about a lot of things. I traveled with him some, and he was a very interesting guy to travel with. Glenn was what you'd call frugal. So if you ever traveled with Glenn, you ate a lot of McDonald's and stuff like that. But he was an interesting guy. He was a man of his era, really, but a very creative guy and very open. And he always reminded me, and I think we forget this, even though we know him in his grass work, Glenn Burton started off as an alfalfa breeder at Rutgers. And he did one of his early papers he gave me, and he signed it, and I still got that paper. It's very interesting. So, but what was the problem with when we arrived? The problems with this grass base, and Bahia grass could be thrown in there too. So those three major species covered a lot of our pasture land, especially intensively managed pasture land. And it had some problems, you know, and it gave a young breeder like myself some things to attack. And first one was they always have an off season, whether it's fescue or whether it's Bermuda, they have an off season. So you have a great opportunity to contribute to the off season, something that'll help farmers overcome this thing. A lot of them just fed back this old hay that they cut off the Bermuda in the summer. So it was not a very sustainable system in many ways, but it was sustainable in one way, and that is it would rely on a lot of cheap inputs. Of course, the main one, if you were working with fescue, was the toxicosis of fescue. We were starting to learn about that now and know how much that was really hurting us. It was a great grass, and it did exactly what it was put out to do, but it did have problems, and we'll talk about those. And of course, grass systems, nitrogen was fairly cheap when I first started, but nitrogen fertilizer, extremely expensive. This was actually just a budget of, just kind of a generalized budget of pasture budget for a grass system from Clemson University. But this was pretty true throughout the South, and this was 10 years ago. And you can see the green part of the pie chart is nitrogen fertilizer. So these things take a lot of nitrogen. They took a lot of nitrogen in those days. They still take a lot of nitrogen to get ultimate production. And so that's another thing. So they were costly now, today especially. And even in their best, though, when you compared them to some of the traditional forages that were especially used in temperate areas, like alfalfa and orchard grass, they had a relatively low forage quality. So when we first started and sitting around and talking to people like Harold Brown and Carl Hovland, it was like, well, we can attack this from a breeding standpoint two ways. We can attack it from the standpoint of helping the base grass, one of these base grasses like tall fescue or Bermuda, to improve its value. And Burton was still working in those days, so we didn't need to attack Bermuda because he was already doing it, trying to increase the quality especially. And so for fescue, that gave us great things. Or we could try to bring in some of these species like alfalfa to add to it and maybe overcome some of these seasonal distribution problems. And when I started, and it's still true today, what we did in that in those days was generally a forage breeding approach that was a classic for, well, what I would say would be perennial polyploid grasses, outcrossers and perennials. And that is population development, where you would develop a population or start with a population. You would evaluate the plants coming out of that population on either an individual basis, on a phenotypic basis, or a genotypic basis. You can do it on a family basis. And a lot of people were doing either individual plant selection or among and within family selection. And they're tried and true. And then from there, you get the superior individuals out, and you can close the population again to start your selection again, another recurrent selection. Or if you had really superior plants, you could spin out a synthetic cultivar and look at that cultivar's ability to work as a cultivar itself. So it was just a matter of how you evaluated that material, what were your selection criteria, how you imposed that selection, etc. And you think back about people who also influenced you. Again, this serendipity runs through all this talk. I was very privileged when I was at the University of Florida. I actually take two classes under Jerry Mott, who was a forage management guy. And being in the breeding, sometimes you get a little too specialized in our training in genetics. And I always try to make my graduate students take forage management for many reasons. But Mott, many of y'all knew Dr. Mott, and he was not hesitant to challenge you. And in class, he would always single out the plant breeders, and he'd say, "What do you know about grazing pressure? What do you know about persistence under grazing?" He always thought, "Why do y'all go out and look at yield and stuff before you know if it's persistent under grazing?" Because he said, he had a philosophy was, I don't care how yielding it is, if it doesn't persist, yield is zero. so no matter, he thought you could give up some yield to get persistence. And so he challenged us a lot on that. And I remember when I first started my career and we were looking at alfalfa, especially because, again, one of the things we wanted to do was add species to our general management schemes that our farmers were using that overcame some of the seasonal distribution problems, the nutritional problems, et cetera. And so one thing we did early, and I remember talking to Dr. Mott a lot over the phone about this. I'd call him. I said, "I really think this early generation testing under animals and then taking what you call what everybody knows in the management arena as Mott's curve." And of course, for management, what you're trying to do is maximize grazing pressure, as it showed in the middle of this. You're maximizing grazing pressure to get the optimum. If you're undergrazed, you minimize gain per area because you don't have enough stocking rates. You're not your utilization for. But of course, because of the selectivity of the animal, you get very good gain per animal. And then of course, as you go to overgrazing, you lose both. So Mott was if you look at this management, if you get into overgrazing, it's not a good situation. Get into undergrazing, it's a little better situation. But the optimum is trying to maximize both of those. But then, if we were combining this, I said, what about, why don't we use selection in overgrazing? Even though it's the worst case scenario, it's really no different than what we do in pest resistance. In other words, when I inoculate with microbes or insects, I'm in an overgrazing situation for that pest resistance. So why not look at cattle as big microbes or insects and just using them as a pest resistance screen to look for, using overgrazing to look at to select plants. And so, and we were looking at that as, again, just a takeoff on what Mott had preached, early generation selection and an overgrazing model. And when we did that with alfalfa, we did that for a couple of cycles, and lo and behold, we could really make progress in most alfalfa populations. And then this became a very important variety for us to release and get it out to farmers. And that's another reason we wanted to have grazing tolerance in our alfalfas, because we tend to be grazers in the South, and to be able to graze or cut hay was very important. And I want to make a couple of points here. That's a little uncomfortable some ways, but you can see there's a company logo, and you're going to start seeing subliminal messages here throughout my talk of company logos. And some of my colleagues were uncomfortable with this, and I quite frankly I was too, but I realized early too that, and this is I realized from Burton, seed companies are in the commercial arena, they are the gatekeepers for your variety. I don't care how good the variety is, they're still the gatekeepers. They produce the seed, they sell the seed, they do all this. If you don't work with them, you're never going to get your stuff out. You're not going to be, the University of Georgia wasn't a seed company. I doubt if many of your universities were seed companies. And also, even the Noble Foundation is not a seed company. So we need to always remember that they are the gatekeepers. I don't want you to think that I think they should influence your research. But even when you get it out, it's good to work with them. And when you're introducing a concept like grazing tolerance, it's good to have champions. And I think many of you knew Warren Thompson, that's him right there. He was a champion for this particular thing. In fact, I'll just be the first to tell you that AlphaGraze would have been a minimal success if it wasn't for this guy. But what he had to do, and it wasn't just AlphaGraze, AlphaGraze became the carrier for his message. The message was, graze alfalfa. We've missed an opportunity when we don't graze it, so why not graze it? And what he had to do was set up on-farm demos, and he did that across 27 states. And many of you probably work with Warren and know he was a real taskmaster when it came to these type of on-farm demos, but this is another important aspect of getting a cultivar out to farmers. They believe your research, but I don't know how many farmers have ever, when I'm doing a demo or, especially a field trial at the university, they'll say, oh, well, the university's got all these resources. I don't have the opportunity to move cattle. I don't have the opportunity to do all they do, you know. And so being able to put them on a farm, you know, and then have that farmer stand up and say what he or she was doing with that variety became very important. So I will emphasize that, too, in this talk. And of course, then we moved very quickly into the technological era working with Forage Genetics, and that was we combined really the AlphaGraze name with Roundup Ready. I won't dwell on where this is all, that all these Roundup Ready varieties are in the same place. They're in a warehouse somewhere. And it's not because these varieties were not good varieties, they're excellent varieties, and they got a very good trait in them as Roundup, if you need Roundup resistance. But anyhow, we did work with them to produce a Roundup Ready version of some AlphaGraze lines that did span the dormancies. AlphaGraze was a two dormancy, which was a little too dormant for us in the South. So now we have dormancy 3 and dormancy 6 versions of those that probably fit a little bit more across the United States. But again, until they resolve these issues, these court issues, and if we have time, we can talk about that. But right now, I can only tell you that they're still waiting on aphids to make a final decision if they're going to put this back into the marketplace. Not just these varieties, but all the Roundup Ready varieties. So moving on now, at the same time, we were kind of running some things in parallel with our alfalfa program, and the main one was working about with tall fescue. Many of you know that tall fescue, especially Kentucky 31, the animal performance could be poor, and the variety was very extensively used, and you know, like most people said, 40 million acres can't be wrong. There's got to be doing something right to cover up 40 million acres of land throughout the United States. And it did. It did exactly what it was designed to do, and that's cover up land and prevent erosion. And it was only later that, after it did that, stabilized a lot of land throughout the United States, especially through the Appalachian Mountains, into the Ozarks, everywhere like that, that they had a horrific erosion. After it did that, then the farmer said, well, we got this grass, and it's covered up our land, and we're in good shape now, so let's utilize it. So the obvious utilization would be cattle. And when they started using cattle on it, they started seeing problems. And it was during that era, especially work out of the University of Kentucky. It was a lot of good work coming out of there. And they were showing that it finally did, and then Charles Bacon at the University of Georgia and USDA ARS just finally narrowed in that the real problem was this fungi, an endophytic fungi. It's now known as Neotyphodium cynophialum. Very fascinating organism. It does produce animal toxins, many of you know, the alkaloids, they found out, but it also was very instrumental in its persistence. If you took the endophyte out of Kentucky 31 tall fescue, well, especially in our region, especially where you had a lot of stress in the summer, it would collapse. It was like with the endophyte, it was Superman, and when you took the endophyte out, it became Clark Kent again, you know. And so it was not a pretty thing. So we were especially at that time with bacon being there, and then I had a great opportunity. You go to these meetings, and I want to emphasize to the younger scientists in the room, going to the Crop Science Society meetings, going to International Grassland Congress, going to the Southern Pasture meetings, all that interactions really paid off for me. And let me just say I jumped ahead myself, but I had my own populations at that time. This became the Jessup population that we used, and it was just like Kentucky 31. It was more persistent than Kentucky 31 in our region, but it also needed endophytes. So I was really stuck with this conundrum at that time. And it was then that I went to an international meeting in France, and there was a guy there, this guy on the very end on your left, no, your right, Gary Latch. He was given a poster on perennial ryegrass. And the poster was, I'm going to take out the toxic endophytes out of perennial ryegrass, and I'm going to put in some non-toxic endophytes, at least the endophytes. He found a lot of mutant strains out there, basically. And he found out that he had strains that produced some very favorable alkaloids but didn't produce the main ruminant disruption type alkaloids, the ergot. In those days it was paramin B. The trimogen alkaloids were for ryegrass. They gave ryegrass to. But anyhow, when I was talking to him, I asked Gary, I said, totally my conundrum, I had fescue. And he said, well, you know, I've got some fescue endophytes. So first thing I did was put my arm around him. We went to lunch. and it became, he had a bunch of strains. And what we did was we went out and we took like a couple of our populations, but definitely the Jessup population. And what we were looking for was that's endophyte infected. This would be endophyte free. So we'd get a classic separation of our checks. And then what we were doing was looking for one of these non-toxic strains to substitute for the toxic one. And there is one of the ones with AR542, and we did grazing trials, and of course what we were looking for was the opposite effect on the grazing. We were looking for separation of the checks from endophyte infected to endophyte free. Again, you can just see the value the detrimental effect of these alkaloids. And then of course it's as we wanted to, the strains to look like the endophyte free. And this became we finally, after many years of work, actually, it became and was commercialized by Pennington Seed as Max-Q tall fescue. But so Max-Q is really a good population, a good persistent fescue population. So you got the germplasm on one hand, then you have the endophyte on the other, and it was finding a good match, a good niche, nick for those two, and that became the first. Now we do a lot more breeding with this material in it. And so the strategies have changed a little bit. But anyhow, that's how we did Max-Q. And then at the same time, I was working with, we had a little clover project going, as a lot of breeders do. They have several different species they work with, which that's a difference, too, that from forage breeding to crop breeding. We tend to work with more species. Maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but we did. And we did have a white clover breeding project. And it was based heavily on finding these naturalized ecotypes. You know, you'd go out there and play. Look, this was actually in Oklahoma, but you know, it's pretty bleak out there in the winter. Not much green stuff out there, so you better be feeding a lot of grass. You'd see these patches, and you'd go look at them, and they would be, white clover, or they might even be red clover, or they could be some of the cool season grasses that are perenniating. So these things had to have some value. I mean, they had to have persistence. Now, from our alpha graze days, we said, well, Ladino clovers is what we're looking for. You know, so if you know anything about clovers, you know that they're really polymorphic forms of white clover. And as was mentioned earlier about Norm Taylor, Norm was he was really a strong clover man. And even though he worked a lot with red clover, he knew more about clovers than anybody I ever knew. And he wrote a lot of papers on this and taxonomic stuff as well as others. But basically, it got down to the fact that they're all reapings, but there are some polymorphic forms that are true breeding, can true breed within, and these would be the wild type, which would be very small leaf types, and then you have the classic white Dutch type, which are more intermediate in leaf size, and then you have the giant ones, the big Ladinos. And of course, if you as a breeder or you as a person, you say, well, which one of these would you take in your breeding project? Everybody say, oh, well, I'll take that one. I'll take that big boy. You know, I like that yield. Well, as it turned out, these were not very persistent. So our thought process when we were looking for these ecotypes was we were going to find Ladino types that had persisted, you know, and become these ecotypes. Well, we went through about 2,000 collections. You know how many Ladino types we found? Zero. So we're not very clever, but we were starting to say, well, 2,000 to zero, it might be telling us something here. And really what they were classically the Hellanicum types. We don't know how long those ecotypes had been there. They might have been there from the first settlers, or they might have been there only a few years. But we based our breeding project on the Hellanicum types. And really what we did was we bred the Hellanicum type in these ecotypes we had collected. Straight collection for a little more seed yield, a little more leaf size became the Durana cultivar. And then we also found out we could hybridize them with the Ladino types. Again, you can hybridize across there. And we did capture some of the leaf size of the Ladino, but we kept the stolen density and other things of the Dutch white type. And that we had some what we call hybrids. And even today, there's still either hybrids or hybrids between those, but or just straight ecotypes. But there are ecotypes, and they can be commercially successful. And this was the best study we did to show their proof of concept on these two varieties. But as you can see from this study, it was a big animal performance study done with Mark McCann and Carl Hovland. But we got a lot better persistence over a couple of years with the Durana type. And when you, I think these data do show that when you're working with grass alone, you can see what happens when you take the endophyte out. I mean, you can see the value of toxins. It almost doubles the animal performance. I let that sink in. I mean, that's a big deal. But you can also, just with a little bit of clover, you can also, with a lot of clover, you can really improve your animal performance on either one. So clover has a value to overcome toxins. It also has a value to give higher quality into even things that are not toxic. So that was very important for me. And of course, when we finally did a study to look at both of them, this is just generalized, but it does show what we found was as we went from toxic to toxic with just a clover, we get an improvement in animal performance. As we go from toxic to non-toxic, we get an even more dramatic influence. And then as we go from toxic to non-toxic and clover, another dramatic jump. So it was at this time we had finally gotten to where we wanted to be, and I had a great opportunity then, and things were starting to change at the universities in the late 90s and around 2000, as many of you in the room know. And the big change was funding. Funding and then being able to, for things you wanted to do, did you have the resources to do it? So I was able to come out to the Noble Foundation and found a division called the Forage Improvement Division. And the president there was a guy named Mike Colley, and he said, have at it. You know, you've got budget, you can go hire people, you can do what you think is best. And so we had a simple mission. We were going to base heavily to develop improved cultivars of forage crops. And we were going to advance the science of plant breeding wherever we could. And a lot of that was how do we apply technologies? Again, if you remember the early part of my talk, Rex Smith was one of the first breeders who ever used technologies, in my view, to look in forage crops. Looking at isozymes to prove sexuality in guinea grass, to now we were looking into an era of genomics and transgenics and very strong in corn, you know, in those days, in soybean, wheat. But how about the forage crops? So what we were able to do is put together a real talented staff. They're all listed here, and you can see what they do. But it shows, again, the teamwork, I think, was another part of the model that we thought was very important, putting the teamwork together to bring these people and bring them to bear. As many of you see now, I've stepped down as director. I was the founding director, so that's good. But now I'm just working for the Noble Foundation in a more part-time basis. So my boss is now Charlie Brummer. And so a take-home message here for everybody, be nice to your graduate students because one day they might be your boss. Anyhow, it's a good team, and I think they're a lot of young. They're young, they're articulate, they're very bright. They work very well together, and they're very good scientists. I think if you can see any of their talks and posters of their postdocs and stuff, I'd encourage you to do that. Anyhow, our model, though, the model we were going to operate under was going to be a model of a traditional breeding approach where we define our objectives, our target species, our target traits. You can already see Boughton's already starting to slip into a lot of commercial lingo here. But anyhow, we thought this was really critical to have a good strategic plan to define what we were after and how we were going to go after it. But we always took a more traditional approach, you know. And to me, teaching plant breeding for many years, I always thought it's just kind of basic plant breeding is know your goals and objectives or your target species, your target traits. Collecting parental germplasm is extremely important. Collecting it, developing it, and then from there, maybe using that model I showed you earlier with recurrent selection and stuff. But anyhow, you go into your selection and breeding phase, and then the real work starts, really. I mean, it's the testing, it's getting overcoming G by E problems, it's working with your agronomist to design management plans, because the stuff we had done still required a unique change in management. It gave alfalfa producers a grazing option, but it also introduced some new ways to manage. You had to come out with management plans at the same time. And then finally, release and marketing. You know, if your cultivar stays in your seed room, it's not going to do anybody any good. And the only people capable, again, the gatekeepers, were the commercial partners that could take them out. But, again, because we were looking, and I thought in my own mind that these technologies just looked too powerful. They had to be brought to bear. And the first one was these genomic technologies and marker-assisted breeding. They were starting to come out in those days. Actually, Andy Patterson had joined us there at the University of Georgia, and Andy had come out with Steve Tanksley and looking at them in tomato and stuff, and coming out and of course, he had worked with Mark Sorrells there, and they were coming out. The Cornell people were still way ahead, you know, in coming out with things, especially for us forage guys in the South. We thought this was big-time stuff. So, but anyhow, the genomics approach, and then, of course, the transgenic approach. Roundup Ready corn and soybeans were already out in those days and showed the power of transformation and transgenics. And then, of course, I showed you the endophyte approach. So what we did was looking at all those as technologies was to bring those to bear in the breeding section and selection process. And then, of course, the agronomy, we wanted to work with agronomists and have a good agronomist working with us and to get our testing and management plans underway. And then finally, some commercial partners. I'll list a few that we work with there. And one of the things we actually were able to do with these commercial partners was not only get them to take our varieties out, but also to invest back into these technologies with us. And if you can get them to invest with you, they have a sense of ownership too of what's going on. And I think it's going to be real critical as we go forward with the new model. And of course, one of our goals was to, being a nonprofit, we look a little commercial here, but basically we were always going to publish our stuff in peer-reviewed journals, especially for research that underpins this process. Emphasizing, because of the nature of our funding there, we thought we could emphasize the technologies a little bit more than some of our university breeders who were just struggling to keep good funding. And so it was, how do we bear these? How do we apply these? How do we deploy these into the breeding process? I'm just going to show you a couple of examples that have come out of the Noble Foundation recently that I'm pretty proud of. I didn't do much but just help these people along. People like Malloy Saha and Maria Monteros and all of these guys, Zingyu Wang, they were very, very talented scientists. And so I'm going to show you a little bit of their work, just for the mainly from Monty. I'll just say that you know, these technologies are for you know, you've got to have an analogy here that makes them make sense to people. And to me, it was always molecular markers are like interstate highways. The chromosomes become interstate highways, and you know that if you're lost in Oklahoma on I-35, it's a lot easier to say, find me at mile marker 10 than to say, oh, I'm somewhere in I-35. You got to run up all of them down to I-35. Or you don't even know you're on I-35. You're just in Oklahoma somewhere. So you just get more and more information. And so you can look at these. You see all these chromosomes that are marked, and they have all these markers. I know a lot of y'all are looking. You see, go into these breeding seminars, and you say, oh, my God, I'm just looking at more markers. What does this all mean? And to us, this is simplified, but this is what it meant. And this is what Malloy and Andy Hopkins and some of the people working there did. They found, like markers on an, you know, like the exits on an interstate highway, they found the right exits. They found markers that were associated with high digestibility. Some of them were negative markers and some were positive markers. This is just an example of a very strong positive marker. And then by selection on those markers, they've shown recently that here was the base population, and this is just relative value. They could select on the markers and make progress. Now, this is really strong stuff because now we don't have to do a bunch of tests and stuff. We actually should be able to carry along high-quality genotypes by selecting on the and selecting on the positive markers and selecting against the negative markers. And even when we compared them to just a traditional thing of just looking, selection for digestibility, we have made as good a progress, if not better. So we're very pleased with this to where now we have markers again for digestibility. We have markers for stem rust resistance, which was an easy one to do. And then we actually can mark our endophytes. And so when we put out a big pot, when we're going to put out those plants, you remember in that little cycle I was showing you, when we're going to put out those plants, we can screen in the greenhouse now thousands of individuals of tall fescue for these markers and only put out ones that are carrying these markers. So when we get out to the field, we can concentrate on things that are harder to do, like yield, persistence, et cetera. But we should be carrying along and are carrying along high quality, stem rust resistant, carrying the right endophyte things. So the power of the technology goes up. The development costs are always what the issue is. And then finally, the transgenics. Transgenic, that's switchgrass right here, but well, you know, it's all the same. You're trying to culture cells. You're trying to use a vector like Agrobacterium or whatever to insert your gene of interest in there. Then you just got, boom, you got a gene in that you want. No selection for that gene. You got it. And here's an example of an approach, though, that we're using there is reducing the lignin content of forages. As you know, you can really increase quality. And this work was done in collaboration with a consortium of people at USDA Forage Lab at Madison and of course, in Hans Group up in Minnesota, as well as Forage Genetics and the Noble Foundation, looking at could we increase the quality by doing some knockout some of the genes in the pathway. And just a simplified model of two of the genes that we looked at early on, looking at some others now in the pathway, but was the COMP and C-COMP. Of course, the whole strategy is to knock out the gene, it reduces the enzyme or knocks it out to where it goes away, and then the lignin, overall lignin is reduced. And what we found was that it did, it worked. As a proof of concept, if we reduce lignin, here's the controls, some of them were reduced 15%, 20%. And then, of course, as we looked at in vivo and in vitro digestibility, they go up accordingly. So this was good. This was stem lignin, too, in alfalfa. And this project has evolved to the where now that there's even a commercial path for this. And we're in regulatory trials, and this brings up, I'm going to treat it in a humorous fashion. Those who know me know that I'm not very humorous about this. But, you know, it's tough. This regulatory environment is pretty tough, but the perception of the public is more along this line. This is humorous, but let me tell you, they still believe that we're creating monsters out there. So, regulatory. We'll end up here with switchgrass. Just to say that for us at the Noble Foundation, you know, switchgrass is found in the range out there. We've always had an interest in it to revegetate rangeland. The Noble Foundation is heavily involved in this bioenergy, or is it forage and livestock for us? And we think, you know, with Rick Dixon's group there, we can work within very genetic, very basic plant biology all the way to through our ag division, working directly with farmers and ranchers. But we know that at the end of the day, the farmer is going to make this decision of whether how he's going to utilize it. Is it going to be cattle? Is it going to be through a biofuel process, or is it going to be biopower where you co-fire with coal or something? So what we're trying to do is do the best we can on this side of the aisle to make sure when the farmer does get there, he has the right tools. We were also very pleased about how, and to find out a reason for utilizing it early, we actually found a niche for switchgrass. We do a lot of cool season annual grazing with cereals in that region, and we're finding out that when farmers came off cereals in April and sometimes early May, they didn't have any place to go with them. They had to take them to the feedlot or whatever. But now we've been able to put more weight on them. If the market's valuing heavier weight steers and heifers, it could go that way. Our breeding program was to optimize switchgrass performance through cultivar development. And our initial stuff was to replace some of the old publics, and we are actually able to work with Ceres to get some material out. We were looking at better quality of the seed, looking at a little higher yield in most environments, and so we've done a lot of testing of this material. So these cultivars are out now if there's any interest in using them, but even the old publics still have a value. And then application of biotechnologies in switchgrass, this seems to be even more problematic to me. Not genomics. We think there's a great opportunity in genomics. It's a lot of development costs, but I just had the pleasure, not so much the pleasure, but I was able to get some of my, vent some of my spleen here and with Steve Strauss. He's a tree breeder, and we worked with a couple of people and even some legal guys. And we wrote a paper, just came out in Bioscience, if you want to read it. We just thought it was an interesting phenomena that we're doing a lot of work on transgenics in these trees and grasses, and it's getting so hard to deploy transgenes into the marketplace. Just look, we can't even get a 1990s technology Roundup Ready into alfalfa. So it's going to be really problematic, and we suggest a few things there that hopefully the APHIS will read. Anyhow, to sum up real quickly here, I thought I had to have some take-home messages, and I think the first one would be, I think you should always help focus your research on farmers and ranchers. What are their needs? And for a breeder, it's you produce a useful cultivar is the best way to achieve that goal. The power of a useful cultivar, I'm always amazed at it. It really can make a big difference to most farmers and ranchers. Again, find a champion for your cultivars. It may need to be you. Dr. Burton told me that. You know, he used to say, find a champion. In my experience, I was able to find one in for our alfalfa work with Warren Thompson. And commercial partners and on-farm demos, I think, are critical. Again, they're the gatekeepers. And also, these on-farm demos are really critical to the success of a variety. I think for a C6 section, I'm definitely preaching to the choir here. I think I've heard so many of y'all over the years say, boy, if the breeders just knew more about management. they designed cultivars a little bit better. But I do agree. I think sitting in Jerry Mott's class was a very, very important training for me in getting to know Dr. Mott. So in addition to knowledge of genetics and breeding, I think you should understand basic management and forage management principles. Just some simple things. Grazing tolerance is as important as yield, especially if you have no tolerance because you have no yield. So it becomes very important that you get an extra year or two of grazing out of this material. Naturalized ecotypes, I think we need to continue to look at them. There's a great storehouse of them out there. And then I think one thing we've always done is we've always examined the animal performance of any new cultivar. Good students, postdocs, collaborators, technical staff will make you better and smarter. I definitely think that is so true. And again, be nice to your graduate students because they might be your boss one day. And then finally, as we come full circle to this, come full down the line to this biotechnologies, they have great promise. They're very powerful tools, but they will be expensive and they will be controversial. And you need to know when and where to use them. And any future use will be tied to their cost-effective application. And that means development costs are going to be expensive. And so hopefully at the Noble Foundation, we're bearing some of the development costs with some of the federal agencies and state agencies to give these type of tools out there that people will be able to use. I put this picture in front of this thing because this is Red River crabgrass right here. And Red River crabgrass is a variety that was developed by the Noble Foundation, just came out of a selection program. And one of the problems with it was people thought it headed too soon. So in one cycle of selection, in good old traditional breeding, we improved the, we extended the heading, very simple trait. So did we need biotechnologies for that? So knowing when and where to do that, and could we even develop all a marker-based thing for crabgrass? I mean, I doubt it. You know, could we bear the expense? So I think this was a good example of that. So for the young scientists in the room, I'd say there's an African proverb that I actually picked up from looking at Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, that I thought for y'all, if I could leave one message for somebody going out the door and y'all coming in the door, I thought this proverb was really good, and that is, when a gazelle wakes up, he knows he must run faster than the fastest lion. When the lion wakes up, he knows he must run faster than the slowest gazelle. So whether you're a lion or a gazelle, when the sun comes up, you better be running. And so that's, you better be aggressive and you better be running. Again, acknowledgments, you know, they're always important here. This is my colleagues at the University of Georgia, students at the University of Georgia, and of course all my colleagues at the at Noble Foundation. And these are some, basically the AgriSearch guys. I worked really closely with these guys for about 15 years, and then of course work we're doing in 4-H-GenX. And many of y'all in the room, that I just ran out of room on the thing, so y'all know who you are, and I appreciate all the help I've had. Then of course my family. I hope I can get through this, but you're only as good as the people who back you up. And this lady took a real chance on me. A good old Missy. You saw that picture of that boy standing in front of those chickens, you know. I tell you, she took a real chance on me 40 years ago. And then, you know, these are our, that's our daughter and our two sons. And this is their spouses, my daughter's spouse. And he's still unmarried. These three are the grandchildren, and you know, it comes to bear too when people give you the Irish blessing, and I wish for anybody in this room that same blessing. And part of it is, may you live to see your children's children. I think that's very important. So anyhow, I do appreciate everything, and I don't know, Chris, I know I'm out of time. In fact, I went a little over, and I appreciate your attention.